everybody. We'll start with some chanting some verses in a praise to the Buddha, because the Buddha is our teacher and the Buddha is the one from whom the teachings came. So we'll chant some verses. I'm starting on page 2 in praise of the Buddha. And the idea behind it is not that the Buddha needs praise. Yeah, when you're an enlightened one, you don't have an ego that needs to be propped up. But rather, from our side, it's very helpful to recognize the Buddha's wonderful qualities, because it opens us up to develop those same qualities in ourselves. So that's why we do the praises at the beginning. And then we will do the, we'll chant the Heart Sutra, okay, because that's what the topic of this course is. And then do the mandala offering, where we imagine offering the universe and everything beautiful in it to the Buddha. Put together with the request to receive teachings. And the idea behind this is that usually when there's something beautiful, we offer it to ourselves, or, you know, to the people we like. But here we're willing to give up our own immediate sense pleasure in order to receive the teachings, because we know that in the long term, the teachings will bring us more happiness. And then we'll do a verse of taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. Again, taking refuge because it helps us in our own mind stabilize which direction we're going in our spiritual path. And then generating bodhicitta is generating the altruistic intention to become a fully enlightened Buddha for the benefit of all beings. And that helps us think about why we're doing the path. Okay, so what path we're doing, and then why we're doing it. And the reason we recite these verses that were written by the great masters, or in the case of the Heart Sutra spoken by the Buddha and his disciples, is because often we don't know how to steer our mind in a good direction. We're not sure what is a wholesome way to think, what isn't. And even if we know what is, sometimes it's hard to get our mind there. So the idea behind saying all these words written by the great masters is that when we say them, if we anchor our mind to the meaning that they're expressing, then our mind goes in that wholesome direction that we want it to go. Okay? So the chanting is an aid to us in our practice. It's not something that we have to do in order to please somebody else or because it's obligatory or something like that. Okay? And then after we do the chanting, then we'll have a few minutes of silent meditation. I always like to do some silent meditation with people before giving a talk, so we can all settle our mind a little bit. So during that period, you can watch your breath. And, keep the mind on the object, the breath, and let the mind become more concentrated and clear by focusing on one object. Okay. So it's not sleeping meditation. Yeah. Sometimes I think people think meditation is sleeping meditation. And it's not running around the world thinking about everything you want to have meditation either. Okay, so in this case it's breathing meditation, keeping your mind focused on the object of your breath. us cultivate our motivation. We really cherish this opportunity that we have for the next hour and a half to learn the Buddha's teachings. These are teachings that show us the truth, that show us methods to tame and subdue our mind, that help us and show us the way to develop and increase our good qualities. So let's rejoice at this opportunity and have a strong intention to take advantage of it. But in taking advantage of it, let's not do this only for our own benefit, but really feeling ourselves as one part of the entire interwoven net of sentient life. Let's do this with the motivation of repaying the kindness of others by transforming our minds so we progress along the path and have ever-increasing ability to be a genuine benefit to other living beings so that they can attain full enlightenment as well. Let's make that our long-term motivation for sharing the Dharma this weekend and especially this morning. This weekend we're going to be exploring the Heart Sutra, which is one of the foremost Mahayana sutras. Mahayana is one of the Buddhist traditions, and so this is one of the foremost sutras. There's several versions of the Prajnaparamita Sutra, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. There's 100,000 lines or 100,000 stanzas, 25,000, 8,000. And this one is the heart or the essence of them all. Okay, so it's the abbreviated form. We Americans like things quick and short and abbreviated. But the thing is that the meaning is actually explained in 100,000 stanzas. So in this abbreviation, we have a lot to unpack to really understand it. Okay. So it's a journey of many lifetimes, actually, to understand the real meaning of this sutra and to be able to put it into practice. But we're starting on that today, and we will certainly progress doing it. Before we get into the sutra itself, I thought I would explain the four seals. This is the way His Holiness Dalai Lama often begins a teaching, as a way of introducing people to what are four principles or four seals that ascertain a certain teaching as the Buddhist teaching. Okay. So the four seals, I'll read them, you know, list them and then go back and explain them. And they very much touch on this topic of the Heart Sutra, so they serve as an introduction and also get us into the material. So the first one is that all composite or all composed phenomena are things that are produced, that are conditioned, that all these kind of phenomena are impermanent or transient. And the second is that all tainted phenomena are in the nature of dukkha. Dukkha is a Sanskrit Pali word that is often translated as suffering, but that is not a good translation. A better translation is unsatisfactory, but when you use it as a noun, then you get unsatisfactoriness, which is quite long, you know, the truth of unsatisfactoriness. So I just prefer to say dukkha and hope that people remember that that's what we're talking about. Okay, your first Sanskrit word. Well, actually, you know Buddha Dharma Sangha, so you use some Sanskrit already. Okay, then the third is that all phenomena lack a self, lack a substantial essence of some sort. And then the fourth is that nirvana is peace. So we'll go through these four seals because they really, you know, outline the philosophical stance of the Buddha Dharma. But within them, there's also a variety of viewpoints. In other words, not everybody who is a Buddhist has the same exact take on the nature of reality and so forth. And there was a lot of debate about this in ancient times, and there continues to be debate about it now. And in fact, the debate is part of the creative energy in the Buddha Dharma. Because we're really taught to think and explore, not to just learn something and say, yes, it's true, and accept it and stuff down our questions. Okay? So when we look at the first of the four seals, all composite phenomena are impermanent. So like I said, composite phenomena are those that are produced, those that are composed, are compounded, those that are conditioned. Yeah. So if something is produced, it's clearly produced by causes, isn't it? Things don't get produced out of nowhere. Now, some people might say that things arise without causes, but that becomes a little bit problematic because when it comes to just our daily life, you know, we have this awareness of cause and effect that is operating all the time in our daily life because we're always doing certain things to get certain effects. So, you know, you cook lunch so that you can eat. You go to work so that you can buy the food. You know, smile at people so that you can have friends. We do things, you know, we create certain actions, do certain actions, knowing that they bring specific results. So that's in our daily life. Then in a philosophical level, would it make any sense to say things are produced out of nowhere? It wouldn't, would it? Because that goes against just our day-to-day experience. You know, we see you plant a seed and it grows. And yeah, there are results that come from causes. Okay. So then, if things have causes, then what are their causes? Okay. Now, you have some philosophical traditions that say that there's an absolute permanent cause. Okay. In other words, there's something like an absolute creator, you know, a creator who was not created, him or herself, and who does not change at all, but who has the ability to create. Yeah. Now, here, if we investigate, you know, can things arise out of an absolute static creator that doesn't change? Okay. So let's come back to our daily experience. When you do create a cause, do you change in the process of creating that cause? When a seed is in the ground and it comes, it sprouts up, does the seed change? Okay. So we see that causes are always changing. They have to change in order to produce their result. Okay. Something that doesn't change can't influence and create anything. Okay? So if there is an absolute creator that wasn't caused him or herself, That means they're permanent, they don't change. Yeah. Then could something that is permanent and doesn't change create anything? If creation involves changing oneself. Okay, you see what I'm getting at? So spend some time thinking about that. You know, if it feels funny because you have some belief that there's, you know, an absolute creator, really sit with it and, well, how can the creator create if it doesn't change? Do I know anything that can produce a result without changing itself? Okay. And really use your intelligence to examine that. Okay. So we see that all causes, you know, change to produce results, and that results are produced by causes that change, and that the results, because they themselves are produced, are themselves impermanent, and they become causes for other things in the future. Okay, the seed becomes the sprout, which becomes the tree, which becomes the firewood, which, you know, becomes the ash, which gets recycled. Okay, things are constantly in flux, changing all the time. So there's different levels of change. When we say all composite phenomena are impermanent or transient, there's different levels of impermanence. There's a gross level of impermanence and a subtle level of impermanence. So gross level of impermanence is something that we see with our eyes. Something ceases, you know, in its present form, it just ceases. Yeah. Subtle impermanence is, in general, superficially, it kind of looks the same, but it actually is changing moment to moment. So let's go back and look at this gross or coarse level of impermanence. That is, for example, when a tree falls down, or when a building collapses, when somebody dies, okay, when the food gets rotten, you know, there's always this kind of level of change that we see with our eyes. The sun sets, okay, the moon rises, there's this gross change. In spite of there being this gross change, because all these things are conditioned and produced by causes, sometimes we're very surprised at the gross changes, aren't we? And our mind rebels about them. Okay? When somebody dies, we're very shocked, aren't we? We're so surprised. How is it that this person died? Yeah. And yet, we all know that everybody's going to die, don't we? Throughout history, everybody's died. Nobody's, you know, been alive until now. All the great religious leaders have passed away. We know this. And yet, even when it happens, we're so surprised. The economy. Economy is a composite phenomenon. It's produced by causes. Are the causes always going to go up and up and up and up? No. We all know the economy is going to go in cycles. And it's going to go up and down and up and down and up and down. But when it goes down, we're all so surprised, aren't we? How did this happen? The economy's always supposed to go up. Yeah. And yet, we know that because it's a compounded condition phenomena, that it's not always going to. So even this gross kind of impermanence, you know, the more attached we are to something, the more our mind rebels against even gross impermanence. Okay. When we're not so attached to something, somebody else's house in Kazakhstan falls down, that doesn't mean anything to us. Okay. Our house falls down, it means a lot. Okay. Just because of what you happen to label I, or mind, isn't it? So all these composite phenomena, yeah, there's the gross impermanence, then there's the subtle impermanence, which means that everything that arises does not need any other factor to influence it, to make it cease. In other words, just its arising is already the cause of its ceasing, because things change moment to moment and they don't remain static for even the next moment. So if we go back to our science classes, this is what's taught in science class when we study the nature of the atom. Okay, are the electrons all in the same place all the time? You know, is the nucleus always remaining the same? No, even on this tiny, tiny level, which we can't even see with our eyes, everything is changing moment by moment by moment. You know, even if the electron moves to another place, it's not exactly the same electron, is it, if it's moved to another place? It's not that the electron is static and unchanging, but it's just the place it's in around the atom changes. It's not like that, because to change places, it itself is changing. It becomes new. Okay? So the old electron is disintegrating at the same split second that the new one is arising. Okay? And that new one, it isn't like it arises and then stays permanent for a while and then ceases. Okay? Because how could it remain permanent for a while? But just in the process of arising, it is already in the process of ceasing. Okay? So this momentary impermanence, it means, you know, that in the smallest split second, which we can never quite get to the smallest, can we? Things are arising and disintegrating. Okay. Now there's a relationship between the gross impermanence and the subtle impermanence. We see the gross impermanence when the sun sets. Okay, we go, oh, the sun is setting. How did it get to be so late already? Okay, we're surprised, aren't we? Oh, I thought I had a few more hours to do something. Oh, the sun's setting already. Okay. But if we think about it, from the time the sun starts coming up over the horizon, from it to get to from the east to the west, it's changing every split second, isn't it? And its position is moving, it's changing, the world is changing, the whole thing, split second, moment by moment, nothing's remaining the same. And so it's because you have this momentary impermanence that eventually you just come to one moment where there's the grand finale, okay, and the sun sets. So it's the same way in our life. You know, when a baby's born, we're all very happy. But actually, from the moment the baby's born, the baby is in the process of aging and getting closer to disintegration and death. Yeah? So because the baby's changing moment by moment, and it's that moment-to-moment change that enables the baby to grow up and become a toddler and a teenager, and, you know, wouldn't it be nice if you could skip that stage, and a young adult, and, you know, and so on and so forth. So it's that momentary change that, you know, eventually leads to death. It's no surprise. But then death, too, it isn't like after death nothing exists, because we can see that the body, okay, which is a result of the sperm and egg and food that we've eaten, at the time of death, you know, the body becomes a cause for what comes afterwards. So if the body is buried, then it gets recycled in nature, the worms have a good lunch, okay? If the body's burnt, you know, then we have the ashes, we have the carbon dioxide that goes off. Actually, I learned it's very bad for the environment to cremate. didn't know that before. But it's very bad for the environment. But anyway, you know, the body gets recycled like that. Yeah, and then if you cremate, then you have the ashes, and the ashes also dissolve back into the earth. So that's all changing, 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 not remaining the same. There's no permanent cessation of the material of the body. It just changes form in some way. And then with the mind, the consciousness of the person, at the time of death, the body and the consciousness, since they have different natures and different continuums, the body gets recycled in nature. The consciousness, the mind, is not form. It's not made of atoms and molecules, so it doesn't get physically recycled. But rather you have one mind, one moment of mind producing the next moment of mind, the same way we do when we're alive. Because when we're alive, one moment of our mind produces the next moment, doesn't it? Yeah. Is your mind the same now as it was when you walked in at the beginning of this session? No, it's different, isn't it? So this momentary change with one moment of mind acting as the cause, you know, the substantial cause for the next moment of mind. Okay, this process continues at the time of death with one moment of mind acting as the substantial cause for another moment of mind. And so you have this mental continuum that in the case of ordinary beings gets recycled by being reborn in another body. You know, in the case of holy beings with great compassion, then they have the ability to choose their rebirth. In the case of Buddhas, their mind stream also continues, but they just send out many emanations to benefit sentient beings all over the place. Okay, but the Buddha's mind is also changing moment by moment. Okay, that change doesn't mean that somebody, once they are a Buddha, can lose their Buddhahood. You can't do that, okay, because your mind is free of defilements, and only defilements can make you fall down. So once the defilements are eliminated for once and for all, then there's no way to gain them again. Okay. But we still have this moment-to-moment change that's going on, even when we speak of the Buddha's mind. Okay? So all these composite phenomena are changing all the time. Okay? So here already, in talking about this, we can see how we understand it on an intellectual level, but then something prevents us from really getting it on an emotional level. You know, we got it up here. Down here, it's like we still want things to be stable and permanent. Yeah? And we're surprised when things end. We're surprised when people die. We're surprised when the stock market changes. You know, all these things are big surprises, and that's gross impermanence, let alone subtle impermanence. So you see that while we have an intellectual understanding, yeah, kind of innately how we approach life, it doesn't match our intellectual understanding. Okay. So what is it that causes this gap between what we know up here and what we actually know down here? That's called ignorance. Okay? So you can see that there's some ignorance obscuring our mind so that, you know, just even on a day-to-day level, we don't see things even in the way that even intellectually we know they exist. And even in this thing of impermanence, you know, we're blinded by ignorance. The more we familiarize ourselves with an understanding of ignorance, this understanding can be very, very helpful for us for calming our gross attachment. Okay? When we have a lot of gross attachment to things, and what I mean by attachment is a mind that is exaggerating the good qualities of someone or something, or projecting good qualities that aren't there, and then clinging, holding, I want, I need, You know those two mantras we say a lot? I want, I need, I've got to have, I can't live without. Yeah. We have a lot of mantras we say daily. Okay. So if we have an understanding of impermanence, gross impermanence and especially subtle impermanence, it helps reduce that clinging attachment, because we see that whatever it is that we're clinging to is in the process of changing moment by moment. It's not remaining the same. And yet when we're attached to something or someone, we want it to remain the same, don't we? Yeah. When you first meet somebody and you fall in love, we've all done that, right? Yeah. Then your idea is that it's going to remain the same, isn't it? Yeah. Your feelings about that person, their feelings about you, the relationship, it's going to remain the same. Is a relationship a caused phenomena? Yes. Are things that are produced by causes, do they remain the same? No. Is our mind a little bit out of touch with reality when we expect things to remain the same? Yes. Okay. So you can see that the more we contemplate impermanence, then it can help us settle our mind from this attachment, okay? Because when we understand that things change, then we don't grab so much onto them. We don't expect so much from them. We aren't so bummed out when they do change. Because if we look, you know, it's an interesting thing to do. You know, look at the things in your life that you've been the most unhappy about. Okay, just think for a moment. Something that you've been very unhappy about. Okay. Didn't that thing come about as a result of a change that you didn't want and didn't expect? Because there was something else that you expected and wanted to continue? It could have been your job, it could have been your reputation, it could have been your status, you know, could have been some possession or relationship. But if we look, you know, so often our greatest sufferings in life are because something changed that we didn't want to change, that we didn't expect to change. Mm-hmm. So we can see that the more we're ignorant, you know, and don't see impermanence, then the more we attach to things and cling to them, expecting them to always be there, and the more we're attached, the more we experience pain when the natural process of change occurs. Okay? So if we understand that things change and don't remain the same, then the mind has more space, because when they change, we're not so surprised and startled. Okay? And it also, in a funny way, enables us to enjoy what we have more when we have it, instead of worrying about losing it. Because we can see that when we're very attached to something and we have an intellectual idea that, oh, this person's going to die or my bank account's going to go down or whatever, then what do? Instead of releasing the attachment with wisdom, we develop anxiety and worry. Because we know it's going to change, but we don't want it to. Yeah, what do you think? That kind of way of thinking behind a lot of the worry. You have something, but you can't really enjoy it, because in the back of your mind, you know it's going to change and go away. And so you're going to do your best to make it
permanent and stable, so it won't change and go away. Okay? Does that cause mental grief and pain? Boy, oh boy, doesn't it? Yeah? Whereas if we really understand impermanence, then rather than try and make something permanent that is impermanent, you know, in order to keep our attachment to it, we become wiser and we release the attachment and the clinging and thereby release the worry and the anxiety about losing it. And when we're free from worry and anxiety, then our mind is so much more open to enjoying what is there when it's there. Yeah? But it's a funny experience. We're not very good at enjoying things when they're there. Yeah? We're usually not very present in our life. We're usually in the past and the future. Yeah? But just enjoying it when it's there, knowing it's going to change, yeah, that actually is much nicer, isn't it? When it's there and when it goes. Because there's no clinging. And so there's no grief. There's no worry. So, I heard somebody once say, you know, when you have a nice cup, you think the cup is already broken. Okay? So if I look, and this is my dear, beautiful cup, but my cup is already broken. Because it has the nature of change in it. Yeah. It's going to break, for sure, this cup. Don't you agree? For sure this cup is going to break. Undeniably, this cup is going to break. You know, whether I drop it or somebody else knocks it over or something falls from the sky, this cup is not going to stand forever, you know. So in one way, the cup is already broken. So there's nothing to try to latch onto, expecting it to always be here and always be the same. If I have that awareness and I let go of trying to make it permanent because I know that's impossible, then for as long as the cup is here, I enjoy having the cup. And when I drop the cup, you know, and it breaks, then I knew that was going to happen. It's okay. The world's not going to end. Okay? So this understanding of the first of the four seals is very, very effective in our mind. Okay, but like I said, we've got to use it properly. If we don't use it properly, yeah, then intellectually we know something's going to change, but then our mind grabs on harder trying to make it stay the same. Yeah, and that's when we get full of worry and anxiety. Okay, but that is not the way to meditate on impermanence. Okay? Yeah? So sometimes when we meditate on impermanence and we really think of, you know, okay, the cup is already broken. This thing is already over. This is not going to last forever. Even my life, you know, my life is already over. It's going to end at some time. It's impossible to keep it forever. Then if we really accept that, not just intellectual blah blah chatter, but really accept, okay, I'm going to die, then that's going to influence how we live in a very powerful way. Yeah? And it's going to influence how we make decisions and what decisions we make and what we consider important. Okay? So it's a very, very important meditation, this one on impermanence. And it actually was, in fact, the Buddha's first teaching when he turned the wheel of Dharma. Yeah. And it was his last teaching, which he demonstrated by leaving his body and dying himself. Okay? So it's a very important teaching. You know? And so if we can really contemplate it, and at a deep level, at first when we think, I'm going to die, or my loved one's going to die, or I'm going to go broke, or, you know, any of these things. At first the mind goes, you know, like, I don't want to think about this. And then we turn on the television set. Don't we? And we go to the refrigerator. We go look up something on the internet. We go walk the dog. We turn on some music. You know, we plug in. We do something else to distract ourselves. Because our mind gets frightened at first by understanding impermanence. But if you've really thought about beforehand the benefits of understanding impermanence, and you're really sure that this understanding is going to help you to be more smooth, more accepting, less up and down and nutty in your life, you know, if you've really thought about the benefits of understanding impermanence and really kind of imagined how it would be like to live with an understanding of impermanence, then when you start to get that understanding, instead of going, it's all changing, you go, oh, good, I'm getting somewhere in my practice. You know, yeah, it's a little scary to think I'm going to die and everything's changing. Yeah, it's scary, but that's okay, because I'm getting somewhere in my practice, and eventually, yeah, this understanding is going to really benefit me and make my life so much better. Okay. Are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah?
I was thinking when you were talking is that what my mind does, it says, okay, I can accept it's going to change, and then I fantasize how it's going to change. If it doesn't change that way, I'm just as smart. I guess I haven't given the movie thought.
Okay.
So, when?
Yeah. So we know it's going to change, but then we want to control how it's going to change. Yeah. And so then your mind is, again, fantasizing into the future of how it's going to change and how you're going to be the director of how it changes. It's not going to change in any other way than how we want it to. So this is actually going to get us into the third of the four seals. We're still at the first one. But this idea of the self that's in control, yeah, that one comes in the third, okay? But it's a very good point, you know, what she made. I said, oh yeah, it's going to change. And here's how it's going to change. Yes, my wealth is going to change, and it's going to increase. Yeah.
I have found, even on an intellectual level, thinking about impermanence, that it also works with aversion and suffering, that things come and I want to make them as permanent as I want to be attachment. So if I start looking at suffering, this too will change. It helps me to lift my mind out of that kind of thing.
Right. Okay, another good point here. That sometimes when we're in the experience of the moment, just how we expect the good thing not to change, we expect the painful thing not to change. Okay? And when our mind is stuck in that painful thing, you know, I'm experiencing pain and it's not going to change. Okay? We get in that state, don't we? Yeah? It's what we call depression. Yeah? I'm experiencing pain and it's not going to change. Yeah? Or it's all, you know, or we lose somebody, I'm experiencing grief, and it's not going to change. Okay. But that sensation too, yeah, are pain and grief cause phenomena? Are they permanent or impermanent?
Impermanent.
Okay, so when your body hurts, is it always going to hurt? When your mind's unhappy, is it always going to be unhappy? This, you hesitated there. When my body hurts, it's always going to hurt? Yeah? This is a very interesting thing to examine in your meditation. When your body hurts, watch the pain in the body and see if it changes. Yeah? Watch if it stays exactly the same. Yeah. Does it kind of get stronger and weaker? Then it's changing, isn't it? Is it always in exactly the same area? Or does it go more to one area and then another one? Yeah. So watch the painful sensation and see if it's permanent or impermanent. One of my friends was meditating. He told me he had an incredible pain in one shoulder. And he was watching the pain. And then all of a sudden, it jumped to the other shoulder. You know? Just how our minds create things. And so you can see this too with mental pain. When we're feeling really down, a lot of grief or depression or a bad mood or whatever. Yeah, it's a cause phenomena. It's going to change. Watch that mental pain. Is it exactly the same every single instant? Yeah. Can you maintain an equal state of depression for half an hour without it changing at all? It actually becomes hard, you know, if you say, I'm going to have, the, you know, this depression or this mental pain, this grief, this sorrow is going to be the same and it's not going to change. Yeah. Can you make it like that? No. Yeah. And we find that even when we're feeling down, there are moments when our mind is thinking about other things or seeing other things, and we have a totally different experience. Yeah. Okay. So it's very interesting to really watch this experience of ours and see, you know, not only does the pleasant feeling change, but the painful feeling does too. And so, like Venerable Senkei said, your pain changes. It doesn't remain constant, you know. It's not going to be the same. And so even, you know, when we're sick or feeling down, just even having that intellectual awareness can be very helpful for us. You know, how I'm feeling is not going to remain the same. It's a cause phenomena. All you do is tweak a cause a little bit and the whole thing changes. Mm-hmm. You could be very down and you look at one of these flowers. Now, for the moment you're looking at the flower, has your mind changed? It's changed, hasn't it? Yeah. Or you visualize the Buddha, or you develop an instant of loving kindness, or whatever, you know? So you can see that we can understand that when we get ourselves into this framework of whatever I'm feeling is not going to change, that we're really not in sync with reality, are we? It's another form of our ignorance. Okay. Then another thing to say about causality, you know, first of all, because we were talking about how things that change must have causes, so therefore, there's no chaos, okay, randomness. Then that the causes themselves must change to produce the result. So that leaves aside permanent causes. Then another thing about causes is for something to be a cause of something else, it has to have the potential or the ability to produce that thing. In other words, not everything can produce anything else, and not anything can be produced by any cause. Okay, that there's a correspondence between the cause and the effect. Yeah. When you plant daisy seeds, you get daisies. You don't get tulips. Okay? So the daisy seed is a cause. It's impermanent. It's changing. But that doesn't mean it has the ability to grow a tulip. Okay? So the results that come from a certain cause correspond to the potential of the cause. Yeah? So there's a causal relationship. So this also is something quite important to understand, because there's causes of happiness and there's causes of suffering. And it's important for us to understand what causes happiness and what causes suffering, so that then we can create the causes for them. But if we misidentify the causes of happiness and the causes of suffering, then we might engage in creating causes that lead us to what the result we don't want to experience, because we're thinking that tulips come from daisies and that daisies come from tomato seeds. Okay? So a lot of times in our life, have you done things that you thought were creating the cause of happiness for yourself, but you didn't get the happiness you wanted? Yeah? Okay? So somehow we didn't understand at that time exactly what the cause of happiness was. Okay? So a lot of the causes, when we talk about causality, there's what we call the substantial cause, the actual thing that becomes the next moment of the other thing. So the seed is the substantial cause for the sprout. But then there's the cooperative conditions. Yeah, the seed doesn't grow into the sprout until it's springtime and it's warm enough, until there's water, until there's fertilizer. So there's certain cooperative conditions that are necessary for that seed to grow into the daisy. If you lack the substantial cause, the seed, you're not going to get a daisy. If you have the substantial cause, but you lack even one of the cooperative conditions, you're not going to get a daisy at that particular moment, are you? You're going to have to wait until another time when all the cooperative conditions come together before you get that daisy. So it's the same thing in our life. Many times we create causes which we think will be the cause of happiness, but we experience suffering instead. So a few different things could be going on here. First of all, maybe what we think is the cause of happiness isn't, and it's the cause of suffering. Or second of all, maybe what we're doing is a cooperative cause for happiness, but it's not the principal cause for happiness. Yeah? So it's like you want to grow daisies. There's no daisy seed there, but you keep watering and watering and watering. And then you wind up with mud instead of a daisy. Okay? So the water, you know, could bring you a daisy, but you don't have the seed. Okay, so it might be spring, and it might be, you know, you might water it, but no daisies. Okay, so when we talk about the experience of happiness, you know, one of the principal causes is, or should I say the principal cause, is our previous actions. Yeah? Action is the English word for karma. Okay? So our previous actions are the principal causes for the feelings of pleasure, pain, and neutrality, or for the feelings of happiness, suffering, and, you know, equal feeling. Yeah. So it's just the same way of saying the same thing. It doesn't matter whether you say pleasure or happiness or pain or suffering. It's the same thing. Okay? So we have, you know, we may be busy gathering the external conditions to get a result, but we haven't created the principal one yet. Okay? So that's why understanding karma is really important, because if we understand karma, then we can focus very much on gaining, creating the principal conditions for what we want to experience. And then, you know, the cooperative conditions kind of come along, or we can influence them sometimes too. Yeah. But again, not always. Sometimes we may have the principal cause, the karma, but the cooperative condition is there, isn't there? Okay? So, you know, causality is a complex thing, but there always has to be a correspondence between the cause and the result. Okay? So in terms of our, you know, the ethical, there is an ethical dimension to our actions. And the Buddha described this. He didn't create it. He only described it. Okay? When he saw sentient beings experiencing happiness, he looked at the principal causes of that happiness, and he called that virtuous karma. Okay? When he saw sentient beings experiencing suffering, he looked at the principal cause of that and called it non-virtuous or destructive or negative karma, okay? Or unwholesome karma. There's many ways to translate it. Okay? So there's a correspondence between what we do and what we experience, and between what we experience and what we did in the past. And this functioning of causality spans from one lifetime to the next. So what we experience this lifetime, not all the causes were created in this lifetime. Many of them were created in the previous lifetime. Similarly, many of the causes we create in this lifetime are not going to ripen in this lifetime. They'll ripen in future lifetimes. Okay? So this means we have to expand our understanding of causality and see that the result doesn't necessarily follow immediately after the cause. Okay? When you go to school, okay, let's say you're going to school so that you can get your degree so that you can earn some money. Yeah? So you're going to school. After you pass each exam in each course, do you earn some money? No. Okay? So you're creating the cause, but you're not getting the result immediately, are you? Yeah. But you're taking that course, then you take the next course, then you take the next course. Because you know eventually you're going to get enough courses, you'll get enough knowledge, you'll get that piece of paper, and then if you go out and look for the job, you'll get the money. Okay? So you're content to do one course at a time, or three or four courses, depending on how heavy your load is. You're content to create that principal cause of gaining the knowledge, so because later you know you'll get the result, even, and you're content, even though the result doesn't happen immediately. Okay? So it's the same way. We may do constructive actions or destructive actions now, but the result doesn't follow immediately. Okay? It's like planting the seed. In the autumn, you get all the daisy seeds, but the daisies don't grow in the autumn. You have to wait until springtime. So we may create some causes in this life, but those causes don't bear their results until a future lifetime. Okay? But then, even when you have the cause, you need the cooperative condition. You know, there's the old joke about, you know, it's a Christian joke. We changed it into Buddhist. You know, are people praying to the Buddha, 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 please, can I win the lottery? And the guy prays and prays and prays, and he still doesn't win the lottery. And finally he says, Buddha, why haven't I won the lottery? And Buddha says, buy a ticket. Okay? So the guy may have the karma to win the lottery, but if he doesn't have the cooperative condition of getting the ticket, he's not going to win the lottery. Okay? So it's the same thing in our life. You know, we create the principal cause, but sometimes the cooperative conditions aren't there yet. Okay? So when we are intent on practicing virtue and making our mind virtuous, we want to create as many of the principal causes as we can, knowing that the cooperative conditions will come later and that we may need, like taking many courses to get your degree, you may need a whole compilation of many, many virtuous actions in order to get a specific good result that you want. Okay, but you're patient and you're happy just in creating those causes for the result. Okay, in the same way, we may create destructive karma, you know, and do harmful actions, but it may not ripen immediately because the external causes aren't there, the cooperative conditions aren't there. So that gives us the opportunity to purify the karma. So that's why it's really important to do purification practices like prostrations to the 35 Buddhas, Vajrasattva, and so on. Because when you do purification, you are injecting another cause in there, okay, that is counteracting your principal cause. Yeah, or that is preventing the cooperative conditions from coming there to make that principal cause ripen. So that's the importance of doing purification. Okay. So, I was going to get through all four of these in the first session. We got through one. We're doing good. Yeah, we should rejoice at what we've done. Okay. You had a question?
I've been doing a lot of thinking about family and cause and effect. Mm-hmm. And I find that I get really confused as far as who is cause what. Sometimes it looks like, say, a mother, I've caused my children some grief from my immediate action, but they had to have some kind of cause to be there in the first place.
Right.
But it just gets to be really confusing.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want it to be confusing, but when I'm trying to sort all of that out, it does get much more complicated.
Okay. So you've been saying that you've been thinking about family, and this pertains also to things beyond family too, that you see sometimes your children are unhappy and you think that maybe something you said or done was the cause for that unhappiness. So it gets confusing, you know, did you cause their unhappiness or did they have some kind of karmic cause for their unhappiness, and who causes what? Okay? So whenever we experience suffering or happiness, the principal cause is our own actions. Okay? So when we say so-and-so made me unhappy, sorry folks, that's a lie. Yeah, so we lie a lot, don't we? So-and-so made me so unhappy. They made me mad. It's their fault. They're the cause of it. That's not true. Okay? The principal cause of our unhappiness is our own harmful actions created in the past. Okay? The cooperative condition for that ripening may be what somebody else said or did. And what somebody else said or did, they may have been doing with a good intention, they may have been doing with a bad intention. We don't know, and it doesn't matter. Okay? We always think, okay, if it's a misunderstanding, then I don't have a right to be angry. But if they really wanted to get me, then I have a right to be angry. Why do you have a right to be angry? Yeah, the principal cause, whether they want you to suffer or don't, principal cause is always our own actions. Not necessarily this life. It could have been previous lifetimes, long time ago. Okay? Yeah, that daisy, that, you know, what do you call it? Napkin seed was planted a long time ago. But it was lying there, ready for this one event to happen. Okay? Yeah. So in a situation like you're talking about, when you're talking about family, our responsibility is our actions. Okay? Our responsibility is not controlling other people's results. Yeah. Our responsibility is our actions. Yeah. That doesn't mean that we can say, oh, somebody, you know, I talked rudely to somebody because I really was mad at them and their feelings got hurt and it's all their fault. Okay. Now I'm a Buddhist and I see that actually, you know, I was just the cooperative condition. It was their own negative karma. Yeah? Why their feelings got hurt when I said these words, so it doesn't matter I said it, you know? There, see, it's your own negative karma. I told you so. Yeah. That's not true. Because we're responsible for our actions. If we do something for harm for a result, we're the one planting the negative karmic seed, the destructive karmic seed in our own mind stream. Okay? So actually, when we harm somebody else, who's deriving the most harm from it? We are. Okay? So, you know, in that kind of family thing, if we said something with a compassionate motivation that we knew the other person wasn't going to like to hear, but we knew that they had to hear so that they could think about it and grow, yeah, even if they experienced pain, we didn't, you know, act with a bad motivation. We didn't create negative karma. But if we had the intention, you know, to hurt their feelings, and or we knew that what we were going to say, you know, kind of, how's my chance to, you know, get back? And it looks like I'm offering advice, but, you know, yeah. So it's something we even construe it like, oh, I'm being compassionate, but actually our motivation is I want to get you. But that's still negative karma. Okay, so we have to accept that responsibility for our own actions. But if we acted with a good motivation and with an attempt to help somebody else and they experience suffering because they've misunderstood or because they're very, very sensitive about something, you know, there's not much we can do. Yeah? And just accept that situation that happened that way. You know, I did not have the intention. I didn't create anything unwholesome through my actions. My intention was not to do that. Yeah. The person suffering, if, you know, if there's a way in which I can help them, then I'll help them. Sometimes I'm not the person who can help them. Yeah. You ever been in situations where somebody's suffering and you love that person dearly and want them not to suffer, but you know you're not the person who can help them? Okay? And so then you just accept, I'm not the person who can help them, and maybe I can help somebody who, you know, can help them, meet them, or get them together or something. Yeah? Okay?
Mm-hmm. So is it possible that somebody who has a very kind of miserable, depressed life, you know, maybe mentally ill for many years and so forth, even though in their current lifetime they haven't done anything wrong, anything bad, no bad karma, it might be totally the result of bad karma in previous lives that they cannot, in their current lifetime, purify?
Yeah. So the question is, if somebody, you know, has kind of a fairly continuous depressed state throughout this lifetime, you know, is that a result of this life's karma or previous life's karma? Because you look in this life, you know, they haven't done anything extremely negative at all. Yes, then that could definitely be a result of previous life karma. Okay? And then how you react to the suffering in this life is creating more karma. So if we react with it, with, oh, I feel depressed, yeah, and then we do the taking and giving meditation, and we say, you know, may this suffice for the unhappiness and the suffering of all living beings, and you do that, you know, taking on the suffering, giving your happiness, then even if you feel bad, you know, you're generating virtue, a virtuous mind, and that virtuous mind is going to create the cause for happiness. And you might, lo and behold, find that it actually changes your mood right now, too. But that's kind of a byproduct, because, you know, you're really creating the cause for future life happiness. Or maybe you do a lot of purification. You do a lot of Vajrasattva practice, the 35 Buddha practice, and you really think, you know, whatever's causing this kind of depression that I suffer from, you know, I don't know exactly what I did in previous lives, but whatever it is, I confess it. You know, maybe I, in previous life, I caused other people mental pain, and so now it's ripening me experiencing mental pain. And so you do the four opponent powers, and you purify, and you imagine all that light from the Buddha coming into you, filling you up, and you think that all that negative karma is just being released and purified. And that can often help a great deal, too. So in many things, we have to work at the level of karma, and we have to work at the level of the cooperative conditions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you do this for others? Will it affect them? Like, let's say the person is depressed and not a Buddhist and doesn't know about purification.
Okay.
But you bring them in.
Right. Okay, so the other person is somebody you know who's not a Buddhist, who's suffering from depression or even physical pain or whatever. Yeah, so what we do is, you know, we each create our own karma. We each have to purify our own karma. Yeah, but we can still do the taking and giving meditation, imagining we're taking their suffering and the karma that causes it. And that actually benefits us a lot in our practice, because we're developing that strong compassion. And it sets up, I think, some kind of energy field whereby the other person's good karma may have a better chance of ripening. Because, you know, they've done all these studies that when people pray for a particular person, very often that person does become better. So I think that the force of our meditation or our prayer, we're the chief beneficiary, but it can also, you know, affect the cooperative conditions around the other person that gives the chance of their good karma ripening. So that's why after somebody dies, we make offerings and we do pujas and different things like that to create that extra karma that we dedicate for that benefit, because that can act as like the fertilizer for their own good karma to ripen. Okay. But then they have to have that good karma that has the power to ripen at that point too. Mm-hmm.
If someone is mentally ill in this life and does actions or that hurt people and is just destructive sort of person, so then are they just doomed in the next life?
Oh, okay. So if somebody is mentally ill in this life and does a lot of harmful actions, are they just, you know, going to have a lot of suffering in their future lives? There's some kind of thing that when you aren't in your right senses, that the karma is not quite as heavy. Yeah? You know, the karma is not as heavy if the mind is really mentally ill. If you're hallucinating things that aren't there, yeah, the karma is not as heavy. In our monastic vows, yeah, in terms of, let's say, our group vows, if you are mentally ill at the time you do an action, that doesn't constitute a full break of the precept because you were completely out of your senses. So the karma is different. Okay, I've got to stop now.